How's everybody?
Good.
I look at all familiar people. But in case you forgot, which happens to me more often than not, who is that man in the bow tie up there? My name is Roy Heller. I teach Old Testament down at SMU. I and my family have been coming here to Transfiguration for about 6 years now. And this is a class where we're making our way slowly through the Bible. And we've gotten up to Exodus 3. Let's have a word of prayer, just some housekeeping stuff, and then we'll read the Bible a little bit, and then we'll go home. How does that sound? Sure. Or at least to church, if you haven't been already. I don't want to cut that out. Cool. So the Lord be with you. Let us pray. Blessed Lord, who has caused all scriptures to be written for our instruction, teach us so to hear them, to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, so that we may embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life that you have given to us through our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom with you and the Holy Spirit be all honor and glory, world without end.
Amen. Amen.
Housekeeping stuff. We're not going to meet next week. The church meets, and you should come, because we're having church at this time next week at 10 o'clock. So please don't. Oh, my God, Roy. Oh, Roy's class is a meeting. There's no reason to go to church. Except for the body and blood of our Lord who died for you. Right? So anyway, please come back. And I guess that's the only housekeeping thing we have. We're now in Exodus 3. I realize that we've been talking for the past 2 weeks or so, and I haven't really talked about the book of Exodus as a whole. We've got a lot of stuff, obviously, to cover today. We've got 3 pages to cover. I've had to divide it up so that this is sort of a big block. But before we start, I just want to quickly go over a survey of where we're going between now and December or May. Depending on how we divide it up. The book of Exodus itself has 40 chapters. Say 40.
40.
The book of Exodus has 40 chapters. That's kind of important. Well, yeah, I guess it's kind of important because it has a beginning and an ending. It has 40 chapters. The way it's organized is that chapters 1 through 19 are basically stories. So far, so good? Which we've been seeing for the past 2 weeks in chapters 1 and 2. So far, so good. So stories in chapters 1 through 19. Starting in chapter 20, I can tell you in those stories, what's going to happen is Israel's in Egypt under bondage, under servitude, being tortured. Remember that? Today, Moses is going to be called to go lead the people out. That's what we're going to read today. Starting in chapter 5, which is the next chapter starting next time, we're going to start a series of, I think next week, I should have checked this before, yeah. I'm a professional and I shouldn't have to do this. I think next week we start the series of plagues, because the way in which Israel is going to leave Egypt is through a series of 10 plagues that are going to come from God against Egypt. And they're very, very bad. Well, some of them are kind of funny. But anyway, we'll talk about that when we get there. So a series of plagues. Finally, in chapter 14 and 15, Israel is eventually going to leave Egypt through the Red Sea. You remember that? Charlton Heston, right? You remember all that, right? They leave. Basically the last half of chapter 15, but basically 16 through 19 is them going through the wilderness, and God takes care of them there. They complain a lot, but God still takes care of them. Which is probably the best news of all. At 19, they arrive at Mount Sinai, which is where we're going to be today. So it's going to be a big circle for Moses. It's going to come right back here. We're going to come to Sinai, also called Horeb. And starting in chapter 20, so that's the first half of the book. That's the Cliff's Notes version up to 19. Starting in chapter 20, and basically going through the rest of the book, we have not so much stories as, let's call it, non-stories. How's that? Pretty good, huh? So what we have in chapter 20 is the Ten Commandments. So far, so good. What we have in the second half of 20 through basically 24 is what's called the Book of the Covenant. It's a bunch of laws that are given, and we'll, yes, we're actually going to read some of those. Please come back. We're actually going to read some of those. They're actually really kind of interesting when you actually take a look at them. We'll read some of those. Starting in chapter 25 through 31, God gives Moses a detailed series of plans for building a holy tent that he can be worshipped in, the tabernacle. While he's giving him those instructions in chapters 32, 33, and 34, Israel is, meanwhile, down at the base of Sinai, building a golden calf and worshipping it. Kind of ironic, eh? Moses comes down, doesn't like things, bad things happen. But then starting in chapter 32, 33, 34, starting in chapter 35 and going through the end, obviously chapter 40, Israel builds the tabernacle. So far, so good. So we're going to wind up, so God gives the instructions. Golden calf episode, Israel builds the tabernacle. What's really interesting, we're not going to read all of that stuff. You're welcome. We're not going to read all that stuff. And the reason why we're not going to read that stuff is that when you take a look at the instructions for the building of the tabernacle, and then in chapter 35 through 40, you take a look at Israel building the tabernacle, remarkably, it's practically the same exact words. When they get around to building the tabernacle, they do it quite literally, to the letter. So the book as a whole ends with Israel doing exactly what God says. So in fact, the book of Exodus as a whole is a comedy. And what I mean by comedy is that we start off in a really bad place, and we wind up in actually a really good place. So, sound good?
Yeah.
So what we're doing basically between now and December is stories. And then what we'll do in the spring is some of that other stuff. And I'll need to find out how much of that other stuff we'll do. But please come back. Sound good? Okay, cool. Let's see what we got today. Again, we've got a whole leader to call. I kind of laid it out. And the nice thing is that there's not a lot of stuff to explain here. So I think we're basically going to read it through. And again, I'll make comments every once in a while. But let's see what we have here. So Exodus 3. And the break, again, I don't have numbers here. The break between them, I think, occurs at on the second page at the beginning of excuse 3. So that's where the break occurs. So, between 3 and 4. So here we go. Moses was keeping, remember last week he got married to Zipporah, remember the well, he goes by the well, he drives the people away. The daughters of Jethro go and they say, oh, we met a man, and Jethro said, why did you let him go? So he marries Zipporah, and Moses get married, and they have a son named Gershom, and he's there for quite a while, Moses is. So here we go. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Horeb and Sinai are the same place. It's called different things by different traditions, but it's the same place. Came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. And he looked, and the bush was blazing. It was on fire, and yet it wasn't consumed. It wasn't being burnt up. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? Strange. Then Moses said, oh, I've got to turn aside and see this great sight, see why the bush isn't burned up. Remember, one of the things about Moses is that he's a scaredy cat. Remember that? We read that last. Again, he just gets freaked out really easily and runs away. So this is kind of interesting, right? God has this type of sign or this type of lure, if you will, to sort of get him interested because otherwise it would be scary. So far, so good. For me, at least, I just sort of understand why this is happening. Did anybody see, and again, we have an older crowd. Well, okay. We don't have any children here this morning. Anybody see Finding Nemo? The movie Finding Nemo? Yeah. If you remember in the middle of that movie, there's Martin and Dory, and they're trying to find the little fish Nemo. And they go down to this abyss, and it's dark, 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 dark. And suddenly this little gluey little thing appears, And Dory goes up to her and says, ooh, you know, and she's sort of fascinated by it. And she's sort of swimming around watching it. And then sort of darts, and she follows it and follows it and everything. And it sort of goes on and on and on. And eventually we get to a place where we can actually see what the little shiny thing is. And it's an anglerfish. And it tries to eat her, right? And so the little glowy, it's an anglerfish, right? And so the little phosphorescent thing on the end is to bring the fish up. So the anglerfish can eat it. That's the burning bush. It's trying to lure him. So the god can eat him up. Well, not to eat him up, but at least to get his attention, right? So that's what's going on here. What's interesting is that everybody knows about the burning bush. The burning bush is one of these great symbols in the Bible. Burning bush, burning bush. Just notice that the burning bush is mentioned in one verse, right? Kind of interesting, because the whole point isn't the burning bush. The whole point is God eating him up, which is going to happen for the rest of the two chapters. Moses looked, and he said, oh, I'm going to look at this great sight, see why the bush isn't burned up. And when the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out from the bush, Moses, Moses. Well, he doesn't really say Moses, Moses. In Hebrew, there's no punctuation. We have punctuation in English, right? There's no punctuation in Hebrew. And so the way in which you do, you notice it's Moses, Moses, exclamation point, right? The way in which you do exclamation points in Hebrew is that you repeat the word. You say the word twice. And so he doesn't really say Moses, Moses. He says, Moses! Right? And he says, oh, here I am. And then he said, don't come any closer. Remove the sandal. This is going to be a theme that we'll see later in December. He says, don't come any closer. Remove the sandals from your feet because the place on which you're standing is holy ground. And what holiness means, again, when I talked to Methodists, I had to explain this. We good Episcopalians actually know what holiness is because we have a sanctuary that actually has holy things in it, holy places in it, holy areas in it, right? Like all that stuff at the front, right? The tabernacle, the altar and things like this, right? And so those are like special things. It's not like a table that you can just sort of throw your coats on or something, right? It's a holy thing. You treat it specially because it's holy. It's something dedicated to the worship of God. So far, so good? Right. We understand, for me at least, the nice thing is I don't have to like go on and on about it because I think we just naturally understand that. So this mountain, this place is actually holy. And we'll see this again in December. So remove your feet, sandals from your feet, because the place on which you're standing is holy ground. And he said further, I'm the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face because he was
afraid.
He was afraid. Of course he was. Right? Understandably so, perhaps. But again, yet again, it goes right along with his character as a whole. He's very fearful. God tells him the plan. Then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. Remember the last time we talked about God knowing their suffering, having an intimate knowledge of their suffering. It's not just knowing it like, oh, I've got to remember to save Israel. No, God actually suffers with them. God says, I've observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt, and I've heard their screams, remember. And again, this is going to be, this is the reason why I keep beating it like a dead horse. It's going to be an important theme. I've heard the screams, not just crying, not just weeping, but screaming of pain. I've heard their screams on account of their taskmasters. And indeed, there it is again. I know their sufferings. And I've come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, right? Plenty, right? Fertile. To the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me, and I've seen how the Egyptians oppress them, torture them, right? And so come, I'm going to send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. And Moses said, all right, let's go. No. Why? And you can already see this, and you can see it from the title itself. What's going to happen is that Moses is going to make excuses. He's going to make five excuses. Over and over and over. In fact, the vast majority of the call of Moses isn't the call of Moses. It's God trying to persuade Moses to actually accept the call of Moses. Here's the first excuse. Moses said, well, who am I, right, that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? If you remember last week, We talked about Moses and how he's a liminal character. He's sort of like this, he's sort of like this, he's sort of like, he's sort of a Hebrew, he's sort of an Egyptian, he's sort of royalty, he's sort of slave, he's sort of both. In fact, in the big scheme of things, he would be the perfect person to bring the Israelites out. But notice that God doesn't say that. What God says is, I will be with you. Moses says, who am I? And God says, you're missing the point. I'm very large, and you're very small. I'm going to be with you, right? And this is going to be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you're going to come right back here. Just like I said at the beginning of the class, you're going to come right back here and worship God on this mountain. That doesn't convince him. Excuse two. So Moses said to God, well, if I come to the Israelites and I say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, what's his name? What do I say? Right? It's kind of like Jeopardy, right? What's the answer, right? And notice what happens here, and again, this is going to be kind of important. And again, we're Episcopalians, we're sophisticated people, right? Just notice the way in which, and again, this is sort of explaining something that's going to occur later in the reading. But notice what happens here. What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And you notice how it's all in capital letters. And that actually in the New Revised Standard Version, in the Bible, again, I didn't do that. That's the way it's written. I am who I am. And it doesn't mean that he's shouting. It means in a sense it's a wordplay. And that is what God says here. Is, and again, you can translate, and again, the problem is you can translate it any number of ways. It's always translated as I am who I am. But it might be translated as I will be who I will be. I am, I will be who I should be. I can be whoever I want to be. Again, you can translate it in any number of ways. It's really actually an ambiguous statement. Because you can't define it. And that's exactly who God is. All the other gods of the ancient Near East have a name. And the thing is, we saw with Jacob, is that when you know the name, you can control. This God, you can't control. This God is very large. And we are very small. And when I say that, it's not saying that we're nothing. But it's saying that God is amazing, right? God is mystery. I am who I am. Notice what he says. And he also said to him, thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am has sent me to you. And then turn the page. And then God also said to Moses, thus you shall say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. That's my name forever, and this is my title for all generations. Just notice what's happened there. Again, we're sort of sophisticated people. Just notice what's happened. God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he also said, thus you shall say to the Israelites, I am who sent me to you. And God also said to Moses, thus you shall say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of the ancestors, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob has sent me to you. That's my name forever. No, why don't you just... It's not edited very well, right? If I'm editing this, I'm taking out all of those and God said, because God just said, and so you don't need a new introduction. Does that make sense? Okay. The reason why it says, and God said, is that what we have here is a confluence of traditions. We have different versions about what God's response is to Moses at this point, about what is your name. And one response is, I am who I am. One response is, this is what you say, I am has sent me to you. Here's another response, the Lord, that is, and the funny thing about God's name, Yahweh, is that it's formed off of the same root as I am. And so it's actually a translation, a version of the name I am, that is Yahweh. Thus you shall say the Israelites, the Lord, that is Yahweh, the God of your ancestors. So there's three different traditions going on about, again, it's not that he's saying three different things, it's that there are three different traditions that have been combined. Does that make sense? So which one did he say? I have no idea. It's not important. What's important is that we have different ideas about what this is, because in fact the God that we worship, and I think also what it says here, is that God's name, that is who God is, even I am who I am can't define that. That one. This is an incredibly mysterious God. And then we have another plan. Go and assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, that is Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I have given heed to you and to what has been done to you in Egypt. I declare that I'm going to bring you up out of the misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Remember that? We just read it, right? So that was sort of the introduction, and God's bringing that up again. But here we're going to have a little bit of difference. And they'll listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel, so we're going to continue that plan, will listen to your voice. You and the elders of Israel are going to go to the king of Egypt, and then you say to him, the Lord, Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So let us now go a 3 days journey into the wilderness so that we can sacrifice to the Lord our God. I can tell you, they're not going a 3 days journey into the wilderness. They're trying to get out of there. Right? It's kind of like being at a prisoner of war camp, right, in Nazi Germany, and saying to the commandant, oh, we just want to go 3 days away, right, and have a party over in, Munich, right, and we'll be right back, right? Yeah, this is a whole plan to get the people out, so that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. I know, however, because God's been reading the Bible just along with us, God knows a lot about Pharaoh, just like we know about Pharaoh, and the main thing that we know about Pharaoh is that he is
hard-headed.
He's hard-headed, he's stubborn, right? He doesn't change his mind. And God knows that as well. I know, however, the king of Egypt won't let you go unless he's compelled by a mighty hand, and so I'm going to stretch out my hand. This is the first time we have any sort of notion of this. So I'm going to stretch out my hand, and I'm going to strike Egypt with all my wonders that I would perform in it. And after that, he will let you go. And I'm going to bring this people into such favor with the Egyptians that when you go, you're not going to go empty-handed, which is absolutely remarkable. If it's like all these people are causing all the plagues, then why would I care about them at all? But in fact, what's going to happen is that each woman is going to ask her Egyptian neighbor and any woman living in the neighbor's house for jewelry of silver and gold and clothing. And you're going to put them on your sons and your daughters, and that's how you're going to plunder the Egyptians. You're going to get all of the wealth of Egypt. And it's all going to be yours. That's a great plan. Wow. Okay, let's go. No. We have another excuse. Moses answered, but suppose they don't believe me or listen to me. And they say, oh, no, he didn't. Right? No, he didn't appear to you. Okay. The Lord said to him, well, what's that in your hand? And he said, well, it's a staff, right? Because he's a shepherd, right? It's a staff. And he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground. And it became a snake. And Moses, of course, he runs away from it, right? Because he's scared, right? Again, he's a shepherd in the middle of the desert. You see snakes every day. But again, he's afraid of that, right? He draws back from it. But then the Lord said to Moses, no, 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 reach out your hand and seize it by the tail. And so he actually does that. He reached out his hand and he grasped it. And it becomes a staff again. That's a pretty good trick. So that they may believe that the Lord, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, has appeared to you. So he can show them a sign. It's awesome. Here's another one. So we have three different signs. Again, the Lord said to him, put your hand inside your cloak. So he puts his hand inside. And when he takes out his hand, it's leprous. Like the skin is rotting off. Like there's this horrible skin disease. Right? You can see bone. And it's horrible and stinks. Right? So he pulls it out. And it's leprous. It's white as snow. All the skin is rotten. And then God said, put your hand back in your cloak. So he put his hand back in his cloak. And when he took it out, it was fine and dandy again. Hey, that's a pretty good trick, too. If they don't believe you or heed the first sign, maybe they'll believe the second one, right? And if they don't believe even those two signs or heed you, then what you do is you take some water from the Nile in a jar, I would suppose, and you pour it on the dry ground, and the water that you take from the Nile is going to become blood on the dry ground. I can tell you that's a little foreshadowing or something, but I don't want to say it yet because I want the suspense to build. Right, so I'm going to pour the water out, and that water from the Nile is going to become blood. That's pretty good and true. So we got three signs. The serpent, staff, the hand, and the water. And Moses said, all right, let's go. But no, he makes the fourth excuse. Moses said to the Lord, and I love this. Actually, the way that I formatted this is actually not the way you read it in the Bible. I've actually formatted this the way in which I think it should be formatted, and that is it's a poem. And I think it's highly ironic, as you will see very because the way when I teach this actually in class, this is the way I read this part. So blah blah blah, take the water, pour it on the ground, it'll become blah blah, become blood on the dry ground. But Moses said to the Lord, "Oh my Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor even now that you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and slow of tongue." He's telling God that he can't talk. And he's providing, off the cuff, this beautiful little poem that has balance, it has parallelism, it has contrasts. It's just a beautiful little piece of speech. Claiming that Moses can't talk. You can tell it's absolutely, absolutely an excuse, right? It's not true at all. The Lord said to him, "Who gives speech to mortals? Who makes them mute? Who makes deaf, seeing, or blind? I'm the one, right? So go, I'll be with your mouth, and I'll teach you what you should speak." But he said, fifth excuse, "Oh Lord, send somebody else." Then, you see the then? That's a very important then. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. Just notice that through all the four excuses, all the planning, all the signs, all the I ams, all the I will be with you, through the whole thing, God hasn't been angry at all. God knows your excuses, clearly. Oh Lord, right? God knows your excuses. But God doesn't get angry. God tries to help. God tries to deal. God tries to explain. God tries to teach. There's no anger. Until he just flat out refuses. It's not an excuse, actually. It's not the fifth excuse. It's just a denial. No. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against Moses. And he says, "What about your brother Aaron?" He's a Levite, right? "I know that he can speak fluently." It's really funny when you read this in Hebrew because it says something like, "I know that he's blah, 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 blah," right? "I know he can talk wrong, you know, I know he talked really well," right? He's sort of diarrhea of the mouth type of person. "I know that he can really talk. And even now he's coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, his heart's going to be happy. So you speak for him to him and put the words in his mouth, and then I will be with your mouth and with his mouth and will teach you what you shall do. He's going to speak for you to the people, and he will serve as a mouth for you, and you serve as God for him. So take this, take in your hand this staff with which you shall perform the signs." And so there it goes. So we have the introduction of Aaron into the story. We haven't met Aaron up to this point. We've met Moses' sister, who hasn't been named yet. Remember in chapter 2, she sort of goes with the basket. Remember? We met his sister. We know nothing about the brother. So Aaron is introduced into the story. And I can tell you that, more or less, Aaron is always going to be a problem for some reason. So this sort of, his fifth excuse about, "Oh my Lord, send somebody else," actually causes a complicating thing in the structure of the book as a whole. Because Aaron, remember when I was laying things out at the very beginning, that chapter 32, 33, and 34 about the golden calf thing? That's Aaron's idea. It's not good. So anyway, we have the introduction of Aaron here. So there's the call of Moses, his five excuses, God dealing with all five excuses, and finally at the end saying, "Here's the staff, go." Sound good? Cool. We're just going to read through the rest of this. You remember when we talked about what shall I say your name is? And we have these different traditions that have been combined into the text with, for me at least, clearly not trying to reconcile them, not trying to edit them together into a smooth whole, trying to tell you in big neon letters, different people have different ideas about what God's name is, right? If I were teaching in, well, I was going to name an actual denomination, but I won't, Baptist. If I were teaching in certain congregations, right, they would have a real problem with that. I don't think, at least for most of us, we would have a problem with that, is that there are different ideas about things, and they're all combined right here. What happens here at the end of chapter 4 is that Moses leaves Midian, where he is, and he winds up at the end of chapter 4 in Egypt, just like God said. Take your staff and go. And what happens starting in that, I don't know what verse it is, but anyway, Moses went back to his father-in-law Jethro. Starting right there, he's in Midian. At the end of it, he's meeting with the elders. What we have here are, in fact, five different traditions about that trip. And they're not reconcilable. You can't just sort of read, and again, we'll read through it and I'll show you this. You can't just sort of read one after the other. There are five different traditions about that trip. It's kind of like, oh, here's a good one. It's kind of like we have four different traditions about the life of Jesus. So far, so good? Right? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Judas? No. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, right? We have four different traditions, and you can't really reconcile them. You can't really put them together into one big whole. There are contradictions between them, right? Because they're written in their own integrity. So far, so good? All right. I don't want to be going too far. There are different traditions about Jesus, right? We have different traditions about the trip from Midian to Egypt. And they're not reconcilable. They're just traditions and they're just thrown in there. And I suspect that because we're Episcopalians, we can deal with that pretty easily. So, here's one story. one tradition. How does Moses get from Midian to Egypt? Well, he talks to Jethro. Moses went back to his father-in-law Jethro and said to him, "Please let me go back to my kindred in Egypt and see whether they are still living." My kindred in Egypt, you notice that's ambiguous. I would assume that Jethro thinks he's Egyptian, because that's how he was introduced to it. So he thinks that it's his Egyptian family or whatever. "Please let me go back to my kindred in Egypt and see whether they're still living." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." Here's another tradition. The Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all those who are seeking your life are dead." And so Moses took his wife and his sons and put them on a donkey and went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses carried the staff of God in his hand. And that one really fits really nicely at the end of excuse 5. Right? You see that? Take the staff in your hand, yada, yada, blah, blah, blah. And so Moses carried the staff of God in his hand. That one sort of meshes. If we just take out that tradition 1, that would mesh really well. That tradition 1 has sort of been inserted into there. Here's tradition 3. The Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders that I have put in your power. But I'm going to harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. And then you say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son. And I said to you, let my son go so that he may worship me. But you have refused to let him go. And so now I will kill your firstborn son.'" This is the first foreshadowing of something very bad that happens at the end of the plague series, the 10th plague, that we'll come around to. But just notice the way it's introduced here, it's foreshadowed here. And that is, it's not God's idea. It's not God's idea to kill the firstborn. It's Pharaoh's idea to kill the firstborn. And it's introduced here. Tradition 4, weirdness. This is what I call it, because this is just a weird story. This is one of those stories that whenever people like to make fun of the Bible, or particularly the Old Testament, they always pull stuff like this out. We're just going to read it and just let the dog lie. Sound good? Because I can guarantee you, all the commentaries that you read on this little story, they're all wrong. Because I don't think anybody knows what's going on here. So anyway, but here's the story, right? On the way, at a place where they spent the night, the Lord met him and tried to kill him. But Zipporah, that is his wife, took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin, that is Gershom, I would assume, Gershom's foreskin, and then touched Moses' feet with it. And feet means feet, but feet also is in Hebrew, it's a euphemism for something else on a male body that points out. So good? So far, so good? Don't make me draw a picture. Okay, cool. So, So again, why, I don't know. She cuts off her son's foreskin, right? And then touches Moses' feet with it. And whether that's that one or that one. I don't know. I don't know why she does this. I don't know. But anyway, she touches his Moses' feet with it and said, "Truly you are a bridegroom of blood to me." And so he let him alone. And I assume that the he is God and him is Moses. That is, he doesn't kill him. It was then that she said, "A bridegroom of blood, thy circumcision." We'll just let that one lie. Tradition 5. Obviously, for me at least, my again, I won't let it lie, but I will say this. To me at least, that little story is a lot like an inside joke. You know, people at work sort of get together and they're sort of friends or something, and you're not really their friends, but anyway, you meet them at the coffee pot and they're sort of saying, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, yada, yada, yada. And they both break up riotously laughing, but you have absolutely no idea what's going on. You know what I mean? Like inside joke type stuff. That's exactly how this strikes me. It's like, I suspect that the people that actually originally edited all of these things together, they would read, "Bridegroom of blood by circumcision." Oh, of course. That's a great story. But we've lost something in 2,500 years. So, anyway, tradition 5. The Lord said to Aaron. Actually, now we're not talking to Moses. Actually, now we have Aaron. The Lord said to Aaron, "Go into the wilderness to meet Moses." And so he went. And he met him at the mountain of God, and he kisses him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord which he had sent him, and all the signs with which he had charged him, staff, hand, water. And then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses. Remember about, he can talk, he's a really good talker, and so there's sort of this, now we've got an extra mediator put in there. So the Lord had spoken to Moses, performed all the, Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses, and performed the signs in the sight of the people, and the people believed. Oh, that's nice. I wasn't expecting that, because they never believed. But anyway, they believe this. So that's pretty good. This might be easier than I thought. The people believed. And when they heard that the Lord had given heed to the Israelites and that he had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. End of the story. So there's the call of Moses. And then these 5, one of them particularly strange, traditions about how Moses gets from Midian to Egypt. We're going to start in the next chapter, chapter 5. In Egypt, and we're actually going to start this thing underway and getting these people out. And it's going to be several weeks before we do that, because King of Egypt doesn't want to do that, as we know from the very first chapter. So anyway, thank you very much.